Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. Our guest today is Echo Caney, who is a producer, mixer, songwriter, and guitarist known for his band Tesseract. Tesseract just put out a new album called War of Being. This is his second time on this podcast. He's also a Nail the Mix alumni, one of those dudes that I just think is the pinnacle of the modern musician. Great at playing, great at writing, great at mixing, great at producing, great at explaining things. Just a really, really talented and capable individual who happens to be, in my opinion and lots of people's opinions, one of the originators of, you know, what you would call either djent or this modern form of prog metal. I mean, one of the founding fathers. So I always think it's fascinating to talk to somebody who, even though they didn't try to create a scene was created based off of their artistic output. It's just interesting stuff. I've also got Spiro Ducias as a guest co-host, which, you know, we love Spiro. Anyways, let's get into this. Echo Caney, welcome back to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Yo, yo. How you doing? You good?
Very good. What about you?
I'm good. I'm tired. I have a newborn, so sleep doesn't exist for me right now. And I have bags underneath the bags under my eyes. But apart from that, all good.
And you made a record.
Yeah, and I did a record. Yeah. album five. So
did you just say you're fired?
Album five.
Album five. Okay, I was like, you're fired. Yeah. So I have a question about that, something that was unclear to me. And I tried to Google it, but I couldn't find anything. Did you work with an outside producer this time?
Yes. Co-producer, engineer and co-producer.
First time? So,
yes, the closest probably we ever have been to having an external influence on Tesseract.
What was that like?
It was cool. Peter Miles. So he also did a lot of the engineering, particularly for the drum sounds, because he runs Middle Farm Studios down in Devon.
Oh yeah. That place is crazy.
It's amazing. It's got a great vibe. I'm going on a tangent, but it's just nice to be able to just go to the middle of nowhere, because it's in middle of nowhere in Devon and there's no distractions there. So you can just focus on the job at hand, and the live room's great. Some nice outboard gear. It's mainly the live room, apart from just being there for a nice place to focus. Me and Jay, the drummer, had done some stuff there a long time ago. And it was just the snare sounds great in that room. It was nice to capture that.
Is that the place that Nolly and Matt did drums for the last Periphery?
They have done stuff there. I think it was a while ago.
Okay.
Well, I know Nolly has worked there. But yeah.
I've seen, but I'm familiar with Middle Farm. The place is incredible and the scenery is more incredible.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah, yeah. But Peter Miles, we've spoken to him. Well, I've been friends of him for decades, since I was like 18, because he used to be in a band with Martin Grech, who's might not be that well known nowadays, but we've worked with him. He did a feature on one of our songs on Polaris. So we've always wanted to work together. So he was in charge of drum sounds, and he just helped produce things just from, you know, all-encompassing global sense of the album, you know, and helps with writing and getting some weird sounds, some kind of more industrial Nine Inch Nails-esque sounds almost.
So like an actual producer.
Yeah.
Well, co-producer, yeah. as opposed to just like someone who's straight up just recording what you give them to record, someone that's like bringing something creatively to the table. So I'm curious, like I'm always curious about this with friends of mine that produce themselves or historically produce themselves, is especially when they're like well into a career. You know, it's one thing if like it's like album one or two, but like once you're like, you have established a way of doing this, which is self-produced. The album came out great, but did it take any getting used to? Did it like fuck with your
working with a producer?
Yeah. Did it fuck with you at all? Or was it just instantly?
I think the idea of it at first might've been a little bit like, oh, done about that. What's going on here? But it just kind of, I don't think it was even a massive, like, we want you as a producer. It just kind of almost happened. We probably discussed it slightly, but we probably just, I'm thinking, like, we went in for like a little trial almost, just with me, Amos, Peter, Miles, the producer, and Dan, the singer. And we kind of just did some vocal producing stuff. It just, that just flowed really nicely. So maybe it kind of came from there. And again, like I was saying, me and Jay had worked with him prior on a different project with Martin Grech. So we kind of knew how he worked and we kind of liked the flow, the way he'd get things out of you or just suggest things, you know, or just deleting a whole chunk of a bit of a song. So it's like, why have you got this repetition of the third and second verse? You need that. No one's just going to get bored of that. It's just little things like that. But also, if there was something we didn't like, we'd just be like, no, we're not doing that. You know, it was quite free flowing. Like either way, he was trying to try different things that we might not have done before. And if we liked it, cool. And if we didn't, we'd just be like, yeah, no, what are you doing? Stop it. So it's just a nice way of experimenting. And yeah.
In my experience, and also from what I've been told, I know that the first time that I worked with a producer, that was on the second Doth record, but like I had already self-produced long before that for a while. So it was like my first time working with a producer who's going to like do what you just said, like cut out entire sections of your song. And, you know, in retrospect, those were all the best decisions. And I don't even remember what the songs were like before that. But at the time, the first time it ever happened, it was a little shocking.
Crushing.
Did you get that reaction? At first?
A little bit, although a little bit at first, but I'm trying to think of some examples. It was like, there was a lot of repetition in one of the songs. War of Being, the first single we dropped, that middle section, there was a lot of repetition happening there. And just said, why is there a third repetition of this? Let's just get rid of it. And that kind of stuff, I was like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. I'm fine with that. But there was another track in Sirens where he was trying to make it more accessible, I guess, perhaps, because it's quite a weird timey thing. Because it's Tesseract, of course, it's all over the place. And I was just like, nah, it's already got a groove. If you try and change it, it's going to like just take away from what it is. And it's just, it's being forced to be something else. So it's just like, no, don't do this. So, yeah.
Accessible.
There's a balance to be had. Well, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Good point. I don't know.
Right. As if most Tesseract fans are, you know, struggling with that kind of stuff. Right.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I should just say like right off the bat, I mean, I'm a huge fan of what you do from like as an engineer, kind of in the age of, you know, AL and I were recently talking about this, but like the conundrum of like the all-in-one modern, you know, producer, engineer, musician, rolling that all into one thing. You, for me, were always like a guy who was like doing that, but at a really high technical level. On this record, was there anything as far as like the sonics to where like you're looking back to like previous Tesseract records when you're like, you know, I could do this thing again really well, but like how much of it is like when you're writing new music, also you trying to kind of maybe artistically put something out there as far as the mix and master goes? Like it sounded like, correct me if I'm wrong, sounded like this record, I just gave it a fresh listen and it's fucking awesome, man. It sounded like even just like the crack of the snare, it seemed like there was even a little bit more like headroom or something. Like it just seemed like it was even like a step more mature and immersive than even previous stuff I've heard from you guys. I don't know if that was like intentional or if I'm on with any of that.
There's definitely maybe a little bit too much headroom. Like I wanted it to be dynamic, but in hindsight, I probably could have crushed it a little bit more. I went a bit too far that way, perhaps. But just
I thought it sounded great, man. I thought it sounded awesome. It was actually pretty refreshing, I'll be honest. I mean, I don't know if, like you mentioned, like the sound of that snare in that room, like you want to capture all of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, for sure. It's mainly the master side of things, I guess, that, and then whole mix bus compression kind of thing. And like most Tesseract albums, there's a lot of low end info in there, and that's obviously going to take up a lot of
headroom,
voltage or headroom. So it's just giving that some space to breathe as well. I actually made the CD master not a lot louder, but that one's probably a good, you know, 2 or 3 dB luffs louder. But I was probably trying to think about the whole streaming master thing, but I might have gone too far that way. And I know a lot of big master engineers don't even worry about that. They will just give, you know, the stupidly loud compressed master streaming services anyway. But
a thing, I mean, because Al and I were talking about this recently,
literally like 2 days ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing though. I mean, a lot of what I always thought was really, I mean, I remember I was like in high school when Altered State came out and we were all like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is a guitar podcast, so I'm not going to sit here and ask you about, you know, D-to-A converters for 2 hours, but like it felt like, you know, there would be, if you ever wanted access to, you know, a massive passive and a lavery and all this just crazy stuff that, you know, a lot of bands in 2011 on Basic Records probably didn't have access to at the time. Mm-hmm. Felt like the stuff that was being made with all that was, you know, it was guys who master a bunch of songs a day. It comes on their desk, they get it done and it goes out. And like for you, like you're the composer and you're writing music. And that's a part of the process to where you're approaching that artistically. Like you're probably doing bounces, listening to the crack of the snare and adjusting the silk settings on your knee.
Yeah,
and you know, but that's like a thing that not many, you know, like
it's a luxury.
Yeah.
It's a subtle thing as well, but all those little subtle things add up.
Totally, man. And it's like, it's interesting. It's not a common conundrum, but I'm of course curious on your take on that stuff. Was there an Atmos deliverable for this record as well?
There was. I only heard it for the first time when we did the album launch last week. Which is cool. It's fun and everything, but I think, personally, being honest, I think the whole Atmos thing is a bit of a gimmick. Like, unless you're sat in the middle or at the front, middle, sort of, like, there's a sweet spot for it where, you know, you got your left and right meat and potatoes of your drums and guitars, and that's cool. Otherwise, I mean, it's a big room. There's like 100 people there. If you're kind of towards the back where I was trying to see what the Atmos mix was like, all of a sudden you'll just get like a backing vocal just going, and it's louder than everything else. Or like a lead guitar suddenly comes in. It's just like, it's not really meant to sound like that. So I don't think it really suits this style of music I don't know. It's a weird one.
I'm curious on your take on that too. Cause like any impression I've had yet of just like metal or rock mixes in Atmos is just, I don't know if it's because they're like, I think they ask for like a lower LUFS level, right? It's like something even lower than.
I think it's quite low. Yeah.
It feels like I've not heard dense music done well in Atmos yet, because it just seems like the summing isn't quite there or something.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Really like spread out, and it's cool. I mean,
I have a theory on this. Because we've done Nail the Mix with like Atmos Nail the Mixes, and all my friends, not all my friends, but like a good number of my friends have been installing Atmos rooms, and it's just like we've been paying close attention to this. You know, because with URM, we're trying to stay ahead of the curve. So the Atmos thing is definitely something I'm paying attention to. And my theory is that until records start, like metal records, start being arranged and written with Atmos in mind.
Starting point,
It's not, it's just not ever, you might get some that sound all right, but it's never going to be like a real, more than just like a gimmick or like some kind of sometimes cool thing. Cause you got to arrange it and record kind of like, you know, when you hear records that, that came out in the vinyl era that sound amazing on vinyl, sound like shit on CD or streaming, and you hear them on the medium that they were intended for. They sound incredible. I think it's a similar sort of thing. And there's a budget barrier for that. So that's why I'm a little skeptical of where it goes with at least heavy music, because, you know, it's a lot more expensive to like do an Atmos production from the ground up. But I do think you're going to see, I think, someone like Devin Townsend, like,
He would probably suit it. Like Bjork, that kind of thing works perfectly.
Yeah.
But in terms of metal music, something like Devin probably worked quite well, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like you're going to see it from like someone, either him or like someone with that kind of brain space, where there's metal in there, but there's also 8 million other things. And
also, I think the whole like spatial, I don't have an iPhone thing, but the reconstruction
their
of it,
binaural the encoder or whatever is going on there.
They usually sound kind of, they can sound a bit phasey and just a bit odd sometimes.
Sounds terrible.
This is what I wonder. Like, I feel like
we're going on a tangent here, I realize, but
that's okay. No, well, I feel like if you think about like a stereo recording, if you showed Bob Rock a Skrillex tune in the 90s, assuming, when digital audio came around and whatever, DSP was involved to like create one of those just ridiculous dubstep records. The techniques those guys were using in just kind of like getting creative with phase and limiting and all this shit that kind of added to that end result. Like, I tend to think with the Atmos thing, we're always surprised when like somebody pushes what you can get out of a stereo recording more and more. You're just like, oh shit, like, wow, I didn't realize you can go that far with it. And it's like, I feel like the Atmos thing, the budget thing is a big deal. Like, no, like I tend to think if it really does become a standard, like there was some, narrative like streaming services are going to start not playlisting you unless you upload Atmos and all that kind of stuff. If that ever happened, I tend to think it's going to be independent producers mixing all with like binaural encoding, not stereo headphones. Because of all the songs that get uploaded to streaming services, how many of those songs were actually mixed on a pair of speakers in a room?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I'm curious as to what that number even is. I feel like so many people are on headphones these days. There's probably some cool things to be done with phase and like whatever implications arise of all these extra, I guess, in headphones, it's like fake channels, right?
But, yeah.
There's probably something interesting, but yeah, I don't know. It's going to be a different approach, right? It'll be a different thing inevitably when it happens, but yeah.
Going back to the gear side of things, like I actually ended up scaling back things a little bit. Like I've still got my trusty API and Neve on the master bus just doing some subtle bits, but I had like a fancy Burl converter, which was just causing more problems in it than adding anything nice. So I just sold it and just got an old school Crane Song head thing. So it just works and it sounds nice. And it's just
nice, man.
Yeah. Go back to the vintage, but the noughties.
Was the Burl just like too fat and messy? And
no, it sounded great, but it was just getting geeky, proper geeky. It's just all Dante woes networking rubbish.
Oh, okay. Just, I'm on the Ravenna if you know Emerging Technologies stuff, they're like also, again, it's like similar to Dante, like AES-67, right. But familiar with that, it can be a nightmare.
Yeah, just, like, it's just
drivers not working and
shit. It works, but there'll be like a little click every so often, only on bounce downs, never when you're listening to it and monitoring it, just on a printed mix every like 10 minutes. I know, right?
Anyway. The thing about that is I think how this is relevant to people listening who don't know what any of this gear is or who are just learning how to mix their own music, which I think it is relevant to a lot of guitar players because I think modern musicians all record themselves. But there's this misconception that once you get higher up, like with better gear, like record labels, like, into the industry, the higher up you go, the less these problems happen. And they happen even with really nice gear. Like the problems scale up along with the price of everything. So if you're having problems with like weird clicks and pops, like sampling errors or clocking errors when you've only got like shitty gear, rest assured, you're going to find a version of that with like $20,000 converters as well.
Ends. Yeah.
And a bunch of shitty mixes done with $20,000 converters. I mean, there's like a bit of a divide. As somebody who's influenced by like really modern polished music, like when you're watching gear reviews of mastering EQs and compressors, and you're on YouTube, and you're like, man, right, okay, this mix idea that I have in my head is probably like coming from somebody just rocking plugins and Cubase, and
it's true,
Not to say that if you go down that route and you mine what is to be mined out of it, like you have, it is a worthy pursuit if you're wired that way. But it is an interesting thing, like definitely a big misconception, I think.
I mean, Peter Miles, the producer, go back to him. He actually said I should get a sub because I'd never used to use a sub. I used to just use my near fields. So it's basically like saying, you know, I've been used to my speakers for so long, like 10 years probably, and throw a sub into the works. It's like, I don't know how any of this works anymore because like my whole reference point completely shifted. And doing that basically through the tracking process was probably not the best thing to do. But it was quite fun because it sounded nice. But but that was just, you know, it's like throwing a spanner in a works and just mixing everything up.
Yeah.
I think it turned out all right, but it was just, that was probably not the best time to do it. But it was, that was interesting adding that in halfway through everything.
So you did half the record without a sub?
Tracking.
Oh, okay.
So it's like when I was tracking guitars, at least it wasn't halfway through the mixing phase because that would have been even more stupid. But as well, halfway through tracking, I was like, oh, I should get a sub.
Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, what it comes down to is what is it that you're used to working with and what are you I guess the most efficient, what do you work with that you understand the best? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true at all levels, like whether at all or all stages of the production, whether it's tracking or mixing or mastering or whatever, like, and a case in point is, you know, my partner, Joey Sturgis, just like when he was the, you know, the man in metalcore and was like making all those huge records, he had zero treatment in his mix room, just like two shitty monitors and wood walls.
But
that's what he knew. And so he understood what he was hearing. And I think that like, that's kind of the, what I've noticed, that's kind of the moral of the story is it almost doesn't matter what it is that you're working with, as long as you understand what you're hearing and you have a good process with it. So even if you have a really nice set of monitors and you throw a really nice sub in, if that fucks up your ability to perceive properly, it doesn't matter how nice it all is. It's going to throw you for a loop.
Freeze you off. Yeah, exactly.
I was just going to say, how did you get used to it?
Just persistence. Just using it, just like everything I've done musically, it's just trial and error. Just listening to old demos I'd done of the album for like referencing and just tinkering with it. And then when I bought the sub when we were tracking at Middle Farm. So I'm also in a room I'm not used to, so it's kind of like a double whammy. But for tracking, it's not so, so bad. Then when I took it home into an environment, a room I'm used to, it's like, oh, okay, I see what this is all doing now. And I could, you know, get into it pretty quickly and get used to it.
Imagine you probably listen to your old mixes on it, right? And like shit you probably know really well. And you're like, okay. Like,
yeah. It's just approaching is very differently now. It's weird. It's a strange one. It's just, it's all this low end I was not hearing before.
As each year goes by, it seems like for better or worse, if you're a mixer or mastering engineer or whatever, it's more likely now that everybody's, if not everyone, has a pair of AirPods. The thing, the playback system that most people are listening to is like getting more consistent, I would say, as each year goes on. Like the farther back you go, the more you're accepting compromise in because you're just like, well, okay, sounds sick in my room. Sounds pretty sick on what I know most people will listen on. Like, hope you're not listening on these. Like, you know, wild swing. I mean, even between like these and the in-ear AirPods, they're pretty consistent with getting most of the mid-range as, you know, it's not as wild as it seems like it used to be. So I imagine that, you know, is making things easier. And all that loudness normalization stuff, for better or worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a guitar podcast.
For sure. Yeah.
Oh, we'll get there. But I do know that several mixers who like do incredible work mix on AirPods, or at least the AirPods are a part of their part of the routine. And I mean like Zach Cervini, like incredible mixers. And so I think that a couple things have changed. First of all, the gear has evolved. Even the baseline middle of the road consumer level gear is just better than it ever was. Yeah. But then also you have a generation of people who grew up experiencing music that way, you know, through headphones, earbuds. And so it just makes sense that they would know how to operate within that. But on to guitar, I am curious, because this is really tough for me. And I know that Spiro records himself too, but I fucking hate recording myself. and so on this last Doth record, I brought an engineer in to at least track my rhythms. I tracked all my own leads, but like, and then I remembered, man, this is why I hate doing this. It's because you go down these rabbit holes that somebody else would have been able to say that was great, or, you know, maybe just adjust a little bit, or like, let's put it down. But when you're just, it's really hard to focus on playing it right, hearing it right, engineering it right. So I'm just wondering, does that mess with your head at all? And if so, how do you, how have you traditionally gotten around that?
So we had Peter Miles as a producer, but he was kind of mainly doing it as a global thing and vocally and for the drums. But when it came to the guitar tracking, I just did it myself. Like, I had my own little, you know, studio B to do the guitar tracking in. I think I'm so used to tracking myself that I just have to track them. Like, I'll loop certain bits and until it just feels right, it just has to click and be like, ah, that's the one. And it might have taken 50 takes or it might have taken 2 takes. But I'm always worried, not worried, that's a strong word, but I would be concerned that another producer might just go, yeah, that one was great. But I'd be like, no, that bit was like a millisecond off or something stupid, you know, a little bit off. It wouldn't feel like I wasn't 100% happy with that take. I know Jay had that a little bit working with Pete. Like, he wasn't 100% happy with a take or two. But then Pete and Amos, the bass player, would be in the control room going, that sounded great, what's wrong? But it's just that kind of self-satisfaction thing. You want to always be 100% happy with it to know that you've done the best you possibly can.
But that's the benefit.
There's a balance to be had.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, though, is
that
when I don't think that we're capable of judging ourselves accurately.
Like, true.
I mean, you know when something feels good, but at the same time, if you're playing it and you're listening to it and you're recording it, you don't have 100% of your brain dedicated to perceiving what it actually feels like coming out of the speakers, because you've got what it feels like in your hands. And, you know, no matter who you are, your brain is divided in multiple directions. And so having that outsider who's like, no, dude, it was good. It was good. The thing is, you got to be able to trust them. But this is, it's a double-edged sword, because then sometimes they're wrong and you're right.
There's a balance to be had. And you're right, because there were times where Jay walked into the room I was working in, the studio I was working in, I'd be literally smashing the keyboard like, fucking get it right. Ah! Just getting frustrated. Yeah. So I'd be going take, trying to get it right. So it's a tricky one.
For me, at least, and people I've worked with, it feels like there's this thing that happens where, like, especially if you're really focused while you're doing it, if there's something you're chasing, or if there's like an ideal version of the thing that you're like actively, you know, again, and you're just like trying to get the thing, your brain hyper focuses on like every little detail, and that that gets more and more refined with each attempt. I don't know if it's that you have an inaccurate perception. I think it's you have an over accurate perception, but your standard is like doing this unrealistic climbing up a ladder with each attempt to where, the same thing with mixing too, but just like you achieve a thing and then you're like, sick, okay, that worked. I can like make it even sick. And then you like keep doing that. And it's not that it's not actually getting sicker. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you actually are like just being self-defeating.
Getting crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's tricky because it's like, objectively, it was dope on the first one. I'm sure a year later, if you listen back to all of them, you're like, oh, dope. Yeah, they're all cool.
Yeah.
Sure. But in the moment, it's like, no, like the pick was making that shitty scrape noise up because of this gauge of string, and I should use this other pick. And you know what I mean? Like all those details. Or
have either of you guys ever recorded with an Evertune?
No.
No.
Okay. This is
Yeah, well, go for it.
You should. Just not, I'm not saying instead of what you already do. I'm just saying as an experiment. Try to record like a section of a song with an Evertune. And what you'll notice...
It'll probably take out half of the issues, potentially, like
intimacy issues. No, or, but it creates new issues. It's exactly...
Your brain just like...
Yeah, so you're... If you think you have tuning nightmares with a regular guitar, right? And you got to do what you got to do to get it in tune. And that's the truth. And you think that with an Evertune, that's going to go away. But the difference, what happens is your focus narrows. And so instead of like 15 cents sharp or flat, you're now listening for 3 cents sharp or flat. And you zone in on that stuff and you hear it just as much as you would hear. Sure. Yeah. And then like the next day you realize it's all perfectly in tune and you're being nuts, but you'll still go into those rabbit holes because your perception, it narrows, but it still is taking up 100% of your attention. So it's a very interesting thing to try with an Evertune. It made me realize just how fucked up our perception is of what we're hearing while we're working on things.
I'd like to try one, but I've always heard mixed things about the whole bending of notes with one.
Well,
there's some like setting. There's like some setting, right, where you can like have it set to where like it will or won't.
Yes.
You know,
like a threshold, right. Yeah.
Okay. So there's different zones on it. So there's zone 2 and zone 3. And so zone 2 is where literally nothing happens if you bend or vibrato. Like,
that'd be so weird.
It's so weird.
It's weird, but it's kind of cool for certain things. If you're playing huge chords or whatever, there's uses.
Power chord stuff.
Yeah, there's definitely a time and place for it. But then there's zone 3, which is the further you get. It's zone 3 is kind of a spectrum, I guess, or the line between 2 and 3. There's a place where between 2 and 3 where it is less responsive with bends and vibrato, but you can still do them, but it's still...
Do you have to overbend, essentially?
Kind of. But if you keep going into zone 3, like it just becomes like a regular guitar. So it's... Okay. You kind of pick where you want it.
Just stop it from going flat, essentially.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, but not sharp, yeah. Okay.
It takes some getting used to, and it definitely sounds different. And no matter what anybody says, it's not the same. But
I'm actually curious from my own point of view for live. Actually, does it help with the bow, like the kind of on the low 7th string or the 8th string, the kind of bow? That might be kind of cool.
But you mean like getting rid of that effect?
Yeah, it's more for like the certain songs, like we always tune. I'm sure bands approach this differently, but we always attune to attack, because usually 95% of the stuff is just da 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 da. So you don't need to worry about sustain notes. But when there's occasionally just like a da da da, it's you've got to slightly bend that root note. It's a little bit, otherwise it's like
it calls for that.
Sometimes you hit it hard enough at the open string and you get like the flat 2, right? Like,
I hate that stuff because you can just get lost in the world of that as well. Just like me and James, the guitarist, have been rehearsing. And it's just like, oh, okay, so for this song, I'm probably going to have to tune a little bit sharper for this song. It's just like, oh, I shouldn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, so frustrating. You could, theoretically set, if you have like a 7 string, like, put the low string in zone 2 and then the other ones in different it's per string.
Wow.
Are you the Evertune A&R guy then?
No, definitely not. I only have 2 of them. All my other guitars are regular fixed bridges. But it got me thinking about the what we're actually focusing on when we're recording, whether or not our perception is accurate about mistakes or flaws. It made me think about recording with an Evertune and how I magnified what I thought were flaws. Once I got a little bit of distance, it was like, no, this sounds great. Like, what was I being nuts about?
I think I personally also mix up, perhaps, because I've got so used to doing it, I kind of blend writing and tracking a little bit too much. So in my head, they've kind of become a bit of not the same thing, but I've just got so used to working that way when I probably should have differentiated them.
Same, man, yeah.
So yeah. Do you mean that like when you're writing, you're going for finished takes?
Sometimes only, I was talking to somebody else about this recently. I didn't used to, but recently I've started doing it because of demoitis, in case there's a lead line, which I really liked on the demo and I can't recapture that magic or whatever. And I want to end up wanting to reuse it or just use it on the final product on the final album. We can just go, okay, it's that, just want to use that, pop it in. So make sure that's in tune and relatively tight or is useful, handy, you know. And we did that with a couple of bits on the album. So, you know.
So is it, I'm curious about the process because I don't know about you, but like I imagine that if you're in writing mode and the ideas are coming at you fast, like because this is technical music, and correct me if I'm wrong, some of it requires some practicing, right? Like you might not be able to just play it album tight or concert tight the moment you write it. So is there a sacrifice in like slowing down your writing or like possibly not getting to an idea because you're trying to track it?
For this album, probably most albums, but definitely this one, again, it's a luxury which I had at the time. If I was writing and it was going well and I've got an idea that's evolving, I'll just spend, if there's an idea sort of like 50% there and I can hear in my head where I want it to go, getting to that next level can take me sometimes 8 hours, 12 hours, but I've just got to keep looping it because I can hear it, but I can't play it yet. I'm trying to figure out where it's going. I'll try different things. And it's just a matter of, probably not the healthy way of doing it, but I'll literally just sit there for all fucking day doing it. And eventually, oh, that's what I wanted. There we go. And then once it's down, I can, if I need to, I can go back and, you know, relearn it and play it tighter. But I'll generally try and make sure 90% of the time that I'm at least in tune, you know, like the intonation's roughly there. Otherwise I'll regret it after.
It sounds like the idea comes first. The idea first and
and I can always, if I do need to redo it tighter later, then I'll just have a break for an hour, then come back to it with the same strings, you know, the same patch and everything. And usually like my sessions when I'm writing and even the final mixes, the track names are horrible because it's just like, it's just the names of the presets on like my Axe FX or my Kempo, so it's just like 14C or 5B bridge coil, stuff like that, just so I know what pickup I use and what preset I was using. I mean, that's obviously, if I'm using digital gear, it's different if you're using real amps, but at least then if I did want to go back, I'm probably going to have a very close tone to what I was using originally when I was doing the idea.
That's really smart. And it sounds to me too like you're leaving enough leeway to where, but you're leaving enough leeway to be able to actually keep the writing going, but at the same time, leaving like getting it close enough to where it's usable, if need be, and leaving yourself enough clues to where if you have to come back to it several months later, you know what you were
get a similar
doing.
Sound. Yeah,
I think that's one of the hardest parts about recreating a demo is. Oftentimes you play it better, but some of the variable, you don't remember all the variables and, you know, you might play it with a better feel, but like all the little details, like, oh, maybe you were in a different pickup position. Maybe the tone knob was different. You're using a different pick. Like it was like all these little details that compound. If you don't keep track of them, you're just going to forget.
Or even the tuning thing. Like we had a demo of a song called The Grey, and we had demoitis with that. And listening to the demo of that now, that actually does sound a little bit pitchy and not necessarily out of tune, but it's just a bit grungy. You know, and it's just, it actually kind of gave it a bit of a character. And it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. So when we did the real thing, not the real thing, the final tracking of it, it just felt a bit odd that it was in tune completely, if you know what I mean. So it's just because we'd heard it so often.
And now in now like that it's been a little bit of time, does it sound weird? Proper?
No, to be fair, no, listening to it now, it's fine. But it was coming from that initial, all we had was the demo and doing the final thing. It was weird. So you just, it's, time and a breather can definitely be a benefit.
That contrast, man, that I feel like one of the biggest issues with demoitis is also, it comes down to our perception of things. The thing that we're best at perceiving is a change, right? Like when we perceive temperature, we're not perceiving the temperature as much as we're perceiving a change in temperature. And when you go from a demo to an album, it's not so much that you're perceiving what's good and what's bad, you're perceiving a difference. And so if you're so used to it a certain way and like you feel it the way you wrote it, because I mean, obviously you feel it because you kept it in the album, so you have some good feelings attached to it, and then you're really in tune to what it was like, and then it's changed. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to realize that you might not be perceiving it getting worse, but what you are perceiving is that you're changing something that you've already locked into, that you're very used to hearing.
Yeah, yeah.
At least in my experience, sometimes there's like a vibe in knowing that like your demo template or recording thing isn't a presentable final master or something, but like listening back to that, usually there's like a thing there that inevitably has to change to make it the presentable final product. And sometimes that's the thing that can weirdly, I don't know, shine a different light on what made the demo really unique or like interesting, when really I'm just like, well, right, you like can't really totally hear everything clearly. But back to the tracking thing, I mean, I'll have this kind of like conundrum where if there's something that's like tough to play, and you know, if I don't play it really well, sometimes it's easy to get that kind of like, you get hooked and attached to a take that you're just like, fuck, you know, I want to keep this. So sometimes I'll actually intentionally, like if I can't play it really well, I'll just do one stab at it, like, pretty poorly. I'll make sure there's some like noise and shit in there, so that every time I hear it, I'm like, that has to get redone. So right, that like, you know what I mean? You're awesome, but like, you're going to go at some point.
It's better.
You're basically sentencing that part to death. That take.
Yeah. Totally. Well, sometimes those stay, but you know.
No, that's smart though, inserting a flaw so that you absolutely have to fix it later.
Well, not like a deliberate flaw.
No,
but
I know,
like,
but it's the
that idea. If I'm like, oh, okay, how's this gonna happen? I'm just like, well, you know, record. You know what I mean?
I think when I'm writing, there are moments where I can't play the whole thing. So I will, I don't like the idea of it, but I will chop it up and just do like, you know, chunks of it.
Yeah.
And then learn it later, because I'm going to have to play it live at some point as well. Yeah. So I'll just come back to it later.
That one's a slippery slope.
It's like, just to hear it. Sorry. Yeah. Just to hear it as an idea. It's like, oh yeah, that works. I like that. And then I'll learn it for the final product. But
yeah,
it also feels like cheating at the same time.
Not even that. It's almost like when you're just comping and editing it and it sounds rad, then you're like, how am I going to play that better? That's usually where, like, because I've been in the past, if I've done that and it's just like, oh, that's the thing. And then I'm like, well, okay, what's going to make that better on the record? The only thing that could be like better than that would be like, if I got it sounding around that tight and I knew it was like a real take, you know what I mean? But because there's been times I've just been like, I'll listen back to a demo from a year ago, and I'm like, how the fuck am I going to play any of that?
You know what I mean? What the hell was I doing? Yeah. I think usually for me, it's just like, I know I can play the part, I just don't know the rhythm in my head, because it's Tesseract with stupid rhythm. So it's like, I know it sounds like this, I just haven't memorized the rhythm yet. So I just have to listen to it a load of times, then, oh, that's it. And then once you know it in your head, it's easier to actually play it on guitar when it comes to stupid rhythmical stuff.
Man, I think that like when you're writing, anything, at least for me, anything goes, because I often write above my ability. It is definitely within my ability, but like you just said, don't know it yet. Like, it have not had enough time to get it to where it feels good. Still thinking about it too much, or sometimes it's just straight up beyond how fast I can play or something. And I feel like it shouldn't slow down the writing because of that. Like, why sacrifice the song over that? Yeah. So I'll do whatever I need to do. Do I need to cut it up? Do I need to slow it down? Who gives a fuck? Like, because if I'm slowing it, I just have to remember, what am I doing right now? I'm writing. Am I trying to, am I learning to play this for a playthrough or a concert? No, writing. Mm. So that's the priority. And then deal with the actual, now I don't mean like piecing things together note by note and, you know, at like 200 BPM slower, but I mean, got to do what you got to do to just get the idea down and keep moving, in my opinion.
For sure.
For sure. Definitely. Definitely. There's a song called The Grey that we released. Well, it's on the album, obviously. I think I wrote that in like an hour, give or take. And that's like really rare for me. This is actually quite refreshing. I think I was trying to emulate, I was on a tone hunt mission. I was trying to emulate some nice tones I'd heard on YouTube. I think might have been a Putney thing. I can't remember what it was. And I was like, oh, I'll try and go for a darker tone. I don't normally do that. And I was just not actually focusing on writing. And then, oh, I like that riff. Okay, that's working. That's cool. And then all of a sudden, the tone hunt kind of went out the window. And then, oh, there's a chorus there. Oh, I've got a middle. Oh, I've got half a song there, basically, except for a verse. And I think I spent a week writing the verse. So it was like an hour for the meat and bones of the song. And then, oh, now how do I get a verse out of it?
that's a real thing when like an engineering pursuit almost as like an excuse to like try to see if you can recreate an engineering thing. You just end up, it's like, well, I have to insert a musical idea here to like make this audible. And then, you know, a song comes out of it. That's a cool thing that happens often. Just like, you know, whether it's just drums like, or guitar,
kind of inspiration
tone.
Thing. Yeah,
totally.
Different approach.
If you're going after some kind of tone, there's usually like a kind of way that it'll like want to be played.
I used to call those tone riffs, like back when studio work was my thing. It was, we used to call it for like reamping or for like dialing tone. It was like play a tone riff. And it was definitely a type of riff that usually just chugging or something that sounds best for the situation. I'm curious about speed of writing because you brought that up. That's also something I've been thinking about a lot lately because I've also come to the conclusion, I've been thinking about a lot of things regarding perception of writing and recording in addition to just flaws, which is speed of writing. I think there's a misconception out there too that how long you spend on writing something has anything to do with how good it is. And I feel like everything, you need to spend the right amount of time for everything to develop it properly. But what that amount of time is, you don't know in advance. Like if you write a song in an hour and it's done,
I mean, it's nice. It's just like, oh, it just normally takes me years, but it's nice to have a song done in a day for a change.
But do you find it difficult to accept that when it does happen? Because typically you will spend longer.
No, it's just it's rewarding. I find when it does happen quickly, you can kind of enjoy it a bit more actually. Cause for me personally, anyway, it's because I normally draw the process out for whatever reason, or I just struggle with writing, struggle to write quickly. So when it does happen quickly, it's just like, this was fun. it's just quite refreshing.
That's a great attitude. I'm jealous. I'm saying that because I've had experiences, like for instance, also with like recording a drummer. Say you record a drummer who's like a real hard worker and they nail a song in like two takes and you know they nailed it, like it's done, but they want to keep going because they're such hard workers that they refuse to believe that they got it done in two takes. And I feel
like, a bit like that.
So I guess when you write a song in like a day, you actually sit there and appreciate it. I'm a little jealous and I want to know more about how you do that. So when you're writing a song, are you writing, is there like an ideal for the song in your head in advance, or are you just kind of exploring and discovering it as you go?
I think so, yeah, the latter. I think it's more just experimenting. I very rarely have a name in my head, because otherwise I'd already know what the song's going to be, I guess, in some way. It's just, it must just be experimentation. I'm not really sure, to be honest, but yeah, so, just jamming ideas out.
So I guess however quickly it happens, it happens. How long typically take?
I'm trying to think about that. I mean, typically it's usually like chunks of songs. So like I might have like a 2 minute bit of structure, and then I'll get stuck with it and be like, oh, I really like this. Now what do I do with it? I have a weakness with structure, like structuring songs together. I'll have to mull over things.
Why do you call it a weakness?
Because it takes me so long. So like, I'm trying to think of an example. It's just frustrating, because like, I'll have a 2-3 minute idea, like Legion, for example. That was the first half of that song. I think I wrote before Sonder, so it was like 2017 or something like that. And we'd wanted to use it on Sonder, but I didn't know what to do with it. And on this album, War of Being, everybody wanted to use it. I wanted to use it, but I didn't know what to do with it. So it's just like, I think the first half is about 2 minutes long. I was just like, I'd love to use it. I'd said to Jay and Amos, jam something. You do it, because I was tracking guitars for another song. And they came back. And then, we haven't done this on previous albums as much. This was nice to actually have some collaboration where they just had a jam. I think Jay was saying he was jamming the drums to an older song. And that kind of inspired a whole new part for the second half of Legion. But they came back to me with this idea. I was like, ah, I like this. Yeah, this is going to work. And it all just kind of, you know, melded together, gelled together. And I kind of did my guitar parts, ideas over it. We were actually a band for a change, instead of just me writing everything. So it was actually quite refreshing as well.
It's helpful having collaborators.
Yeah, no, it's definitely refreshing. It just added a whole new freshness to it, definitely.
When you write, are you thinking, like, do you consider yourself a songwriter or more of like a composer, like music writer?
What's the difference?
The difference, in my opinion, is that songs are very structure oriented. Like a song is very, in my opinion, is very much, like, I mean, you can do both, but like a song, yeah, is very much like an idea. It's like this idea, this feeling, and there's this structure that gets us through this feeling. And it's like it's much more regimented. Like, I'm going to sit down, here's the chorus, here's the verse. I don't know what the pre-chorus is yet, but there's going to be one. I don't know what the bridge is yet, but there's going to be one. Oh, maybe we'll take the verse and like put in a different key, and now we got the bridge. But like, it's very much like more structured, in as opposed to I'm just writing music. It's going to turn into a song, but like, it's much more open-ended, like kind of thing. In my opinion, that's the difference.
Yeah, I guess I'm more of a composer then, because it's literally. I remember when I was younger, I used to get really kind of bored of the typical verse chorus middle eight kind of structure. Obviously it's great now. It's just me being a stupid 16-year-old who got bored of pop songs. There's merit to have structure. Maybe that's why I didn't like it, is because I'm frustrated that I have a weakness with getting structure together in a song. But I think, yeah, my structures in Tesseract songs tend to be a little bit all over the place. And I tend to write, I'm quite good at writing outros, and it's like, okay, what do I do for the rest of the song? What am I going to do for the chorus, you know?
So do you start with an outro sometimes?
Yeah, but I won't be thinking like, oh, this is the outro, but a lot of the times it's like, oh yeah, that's going to end up as the outro. I don't think of it writing it as an outro, it just ends up that way, sort of thing.
Got it. So yeah. I want to understand more about your writing process, just because your songs are crazy, and but they're very recognizable, and you know, you keep going to new places with them, but like it's interesting to me with these non-traditional styles of music, how they get put together into something that works. And so if I'm understanding correctly, you'll end up with like, okay, so you have like 2 minutes of a song here, 2 minutes of a song there. And will you ever take like these 2 minutes from that song, those 2 minutes from this other and put them together, or is it strictly like that 2 minute piece is going to get developed on its own, this other 2 minute piece? And
it can be a bit of both, but generally it's, I'll have the 2 minute idea and then maybe 2 years later, I'll have written some other bits and then I'll just be listening through ideas and I'll suddenly realize like, oh, those two bits in the same key or in the same tempo, or I can do some jiggery there and like, oh, that would link into that. But it can take a long time for me to actually realize that, and it could be quite a simple idea.
That's a thing that, especially if you're writing stuff for a record or something, where you have a bunch of riffs and like songs, like sometimes you won't realize there's like a through line where it's like, oh, I wrote five different riffs imagining kind of the same tempo and they're all like, you know, in the same tuning or like key or whatever. A record like And Justice for All or something is where like it's kind of just like one big song at, you know, in E, you know, like at like one tempo or whatever. And sometimes it takes realizing like, well, shit, okay, if I just change the tuning on this riff and like slow it down 10 BPM, it is this song basically.
Yeah. And just like I had ideas where I thought this would link into that. But yeah, I'd have to slow it down a little bit for it to match, or I'd have to transpose it and then it would work perfectly. Like there's an instance of that in War of Being. It was an idea I just put on Instagram. It's just a da-da-da-den, da-da-da-den, da-da-da-da-den, da-da-da-da-den. Didn't know what to do with it. And I realized that could go on to the start of War of Being. It would actually flow into that, but I'd have to change the tuning. But it took me 2 years to realize that.
on that exact note, do you ever run into the issue of like, if you're, let's say you're writing a song and you're working on different parts of it over a different amount of time, like you write what ends up being the like main riff 1 year, and then a big part of the song ends up coming out a different, you know, you write it a way later. Sometimes I'll run into this issue where I'll be like, oh, right, yeah, this could work for that song. That's vaguely at like this tempo. Mm. But then like my memory of it shift, like the tempo will be shifted off, not so much that like the perception of the music is that different, but the template that I was working in is actually like 15 BPM slower. And like that riff now doesn't quite do it.
Yeah, that kind of thing always happens. It can get quite maddening. Tough. Sometimes it works, or sometimes you have to speed that bit up, or if it's a really old idea, you might just not like it anymore. There's that risk as well, because it's just become kind of dated.
But yeah.
Amongst all that, you've also got to make sure it doesn't sound like a riff salad as well. So there's that trickiness to think about.
that's the never ending struggle, right?
Yeah, right.
This style of music.
Figure that out.
I feel like if you think that structure is your flaw, that must be something that you're constantly fighting, then the riff salad.
True. Yeah.
It's also proven to work for you guys. It's easy to see something as like a quote unquote flaw when you have, you know, people inspired by the music you make, you know what I mean? Who would say the exact opposite?
Yeah. Maybe that's why I'm spending so much time focused on it, perhaps, but yeah, it's an interesting one.
Well, we can only, all we hear is our own bullshit, you know, when we hear our stuff, like to other people, it's just music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't hear riff salad in what you guys do, but I definitely hear, you know, I definitely hear non-traditional structures and, and you know, prog, man. Like, goes where it wants to go. But I think that there's a big difference. There's a difference between that and like shitty bands that just, here's a riff, here's another 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 riff that has nothing to do with it, here's another.
But you know what's funny about that, though? There's a lot of people that love that. I don't know, lately I've been kind of in this headspace of just kind of being taken aback by like how wild it is that we can reach so many people on the internet. But you just start to see like there's so much shit that people are into. Like so much stuff. And like, there's stuff that can be like humbling when you have this objective, like this is sick and this is like, this thing invalidates this other thing. And like, but then you know, you see people who are just super into that thing that you were kind of like convinced was like an objective lesser version of some other thing. Not to say we shouldn't all have our tastes, but it's just, I don't know. It's an interesting one.
There's enough, there's to each their own out there. But I guess I don't mean like when you take a band like Dying Fetus and they have like they don't repeat a single riff in a song, but it's sick. Like, I don't mean that. Because if you take a band like one of those death metal bands that are sick, and there is literally zero repetitions, but everything flows. And, you know, it's not like a song, but it's that.
But does it flow? Does it flow just because they're like dying fetus and it's sick and like they have the conviction? Like, I wonder how many of these things are like subtle shifts in like how you perceive someone presenting their art or whatever that can like make the difference between it being, oh, whoa, this is like cool versus, you know, just kind of judging it. And I don't know, not to cut you off though on that point, but.
I think it just comes down to how good the parts are and how much they flow.
I mean, I'm thinking of Meshuggah because I used to listen to Meshuggah all the time when I was a teenager.
Great example.
They're not necessarily traditional structure either. They'll have a recurring theme or whatever. It might have some of their songs have a kind of verse and chorus kind of vibe, but then it will just go somewhere else entirely.
It's
an interesting one.
But like it all works. I've always wondered how bands like that or Opeth can get away with that much repetition. Like, it's so fearless.
Because it's fearless, right? Oh, yeah. Guard, go ahead.
I was going to say it's hypnotic.
It is hypnotic.
Anyway. Yeah.
But there's a big difference between hypnotic and boring, right?
True. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
Like, those bands aren't boring. And like, when Opeth plays a riff like 18 times in a row, for some reason, it's awesome.
It's the conviction, though, right? Like, they've earned your respect out of the gate to where, you know, you're willing to go where they're taking you. I think that's like a big part of it. At least just for me, when I listen to music, I don't know, it's not something I can like quantify, but just like however my brain perceives, you know, some band or artist presenting their music, there's usually some amount of like patience that I have based on just that perception of it. Your band is like, I mean, you know, I was a huge fan of your band for a long time. It's not like a conscious like thing that you can like really break down. It's just that like, yeah, there's certain artists where you're just like, yeah, I'm willing to go wherever you take this. And then others where you're definitely not, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it depends on the person, right?
You know? Yeah, for sure.
So what's next, Ackle?
What's next?
Yeah.
Well, I'm off to the States for the US tour in like a week's time almost, I think. So I've been prepping for about a month, trying to learn all the songs. That's been fun. Oh God, still trying to learn everything.
So one last thing I want to ask you about, speaking of that, because we're running out of time, on a guitar note, when it comes to relearning your songs, especially ones that you've never played before, what's your process for getting them good to go?
Generally, I'll have a vibe of remember how to play the songs, but I'll roughly know, hopefully, roughly like the fret it was or roughly where it is. So that's a good start. But I usually have to just solo the multi tracks and just sometimes I'll have to. There's been instances where it's like, what fucking note was I playing there? I've got no clue. And I'll just have to kind of loop like a 16th and it was going down, 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 down. Is that note? I hope it's that note. What's that note now? So there are occasions where it's a lot of just completely having to figure it out again. And I know some people like to put all their stuff into Guitar Pro and tab it all down. I've never liked that process and I despise that software for some reason, or just any kind of writing down tabs. It's just, I'd rather just relearn it by ear. Yeah.
I feel.
Find it very tedious. So I'd just do it by ear because I know I can usually pick it up. If it's your own stuff, you'll click back into it, I find, personally.
I think that you're right. Clicking back into it is the key.
Yeah. You might play it on a different sort of, you might end up playing an inversion of it or playing it on a different string perhaps, but it's generally, you'll figure it out, I find. This might take a bit of time.
Do you ever find relearning something to where you're like, oh, right, that was that like studio trick where we like tuned a different guitar for that one riff that I realized I can't play on.
Or I might think like, oh shit, I had a capo one after messing around with it for 2 hours. I was like, why can't I play this?
Yeah.
There is one idea we had from like 2015 that I just can't figure it out. So maybe I should start using Guitar Pro. But
I did that on this last record. There's some riffs where now it's playable in regular tuning, but it just sounded so much better to tune the whole guitar to like a minor chord or something. It just made it like, it made the strum so much, like the ability to just like play it cool was just better. But I don't remember what that is anymore.
But you know, live, right? Like who's, it's like,
well, it is playable in the regular tuning. So that's, that is key. So, we just adjusted the tuning to make it sound even better, I guess, like to facilitate the playing in a way that would be even, even cooler or something. And it, but then I don't remember when we did that.
That's frustrating.
There's one thing I did want to ask you as far as like going out and playing this stuff live. How involved are you as being the guy who's bouncing final masters to like, how involved are you in the live sound in terms of getting this stuff to translate with those details that you're, you know, trying to get forward?
Yeah, I've been spending the last month doing all the MIDI programming because all our, you know, Cortex is rough stage. So I've been messing with all that stuff. Yeah, sorting out all the samples, you know, the playback samples, backing vocal stuff. In the past, I used to be a monitor guy essentially as well, and I'd be, we'd spend a day with me getting all the drum sounds dialed in, but now just front of house can do that. They've kind of got two jobs and they can do it from front of house. So it's kind of nice to not have to do that as well. So yeah, I'm looking forward to rehearsal and just lots of, I hope I've brought all the files with me, but I've backed it up in like three paces, but yeah.
There you go.
Is it a laptop that controls patch changes and everything?
We've done that since day one, just because the amount of different sounds we had, we kind of needed it.
Yeah.
All the different tempos and stuff going on. Yeah, we only just recently got the whole backup laptop thing going on. You know, if one fails, it flicks to the other. We only just got that set up, which is quite a nice.
Oh, like in real time?
Yeah. That's cool. If one goes down, it flips to the other. It's awesome. A basic setup, but it's, yeah, it's nice just to have that. Having gear anxiety reduced slightly on stage, because I tend to get anxious on stage about gear more than anything else. Just like, oh, did I plug that in?
Understandable.
Did I definitely check that? You know, just have one or two gigs or a cable breaks or you forget to plug a pedal in and then one, two, three, four. Oh, there's no guitars. Oh, I didn't plug that pedal in. God damn it.
Have you ever been hosed by the computer with like patch changes or it crashing with, you know, some of the click track's gone and chaos? I think
touch wood, there's never been anything like majorly has gone wrong. We played a festival once a few years ago, but this was more down to human error. It was the band after us was setting up next to us on the side of stage. And they very nicely managed to unplug the power to our in-ear monitors, but luckily not the the interface. So, you know, the click track's still going, the patch changes are still going, and the Kempers are still on and stuff. But we couldn't hear anything. I've just got with Jay looking at me like, oh, it's still going. And then I think Amos, our bass player, went over, fronts the guy who unplugged it all, plugged it back in. And we were still just about in time with the click track. It was like, oh, it's kind of to kind of chase up to it. But yeah, that was terrifying because it's in front of tens of thousands of people.
That's a nightmare.
Yeah, I know. I hate that shit. But
I've had a back in the early days of MIDI control patch changes, had a patch change that somehow didn't do the right thing. It set all our guitars to DI. Just straight up DI with nothing. Yeah, it was supposed to on like, you know, on like a Dremel picking riff.
So sounded like pretty awesome, dude. That's kind of awesome.
But the thing is, we couldn't. It was like you couldn't change it. Like you couldn't press a pedal and then bypass it. You're just locked in until the next patch change, and then it switched back to normal. But oh god.
I think most of the problems we've had like that or things going wrong have usually been down to human error 99% of the time, touch wood. I remember we played Download Festival once and all day, like we'd set up quite early in the morning and all day I was like, I've forgotten to do something, but I can't think what the hell it is. And we have interviews and stuff. Go to sound line check and that's all fine. So I guess it's fine. Get on stage and the way I have, used to have my Kemper rooted, I'd have an effects loop for like a fuzz pedal. So during line check, that bit, the effects loop isn't on. So it line checks fine, but for the first song, it uses an effects loop and the pedal wasn't plugged in basically for the power.
Oh, jeez.
So walk on stage, 1, 2, 3, 4. And it's just literally like you said, the DI sound. It's just like, we're headbanging to just drums and bass and a doo. just pretend this is fine, and then just had to run over to the side of stage and fix it for the verse, basically. But it just throws you off when shit like that happens, though. Or at least me personally.
On your band, you guys could probably switch to your coil split tone and probably pull it off.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, right. That's a good point. Yeah.
Do you find that it depends where in the show it happens, how much it affects you mentally?
Mm.
Like, say it happens first chord. Your first note.
Yeah, that's just like, ah, fuck, it's ruined the whole vibe. But then the gig was fine, to be fair, after that. It wasn't really an issue. And I guess if it'd be more awkward if it was a bad gig, because it's just going to make the gig feel even longer. If it's a fun gig, fun crowd, that's just going to be like, it's just all going to be, who cares, sort of thing. I've had a similar thing in Norway where I think the fire alarm went off and it just cut out all the power to everything. And it's just the noise your ears make when all the transmitters go. It's just like this massive pop. So all of a sudden, everyone on stage is just deafened.
Guessing there wasn't actually a fire.
No, of course not.
Of course.
I think that happened 3 times. When on the third time, my sound guy just put some like when we walked on again. So it's like, fuck's sake. There's been plenty of times like that of shit going wrong.
Yeah, I feel like the anticipation of shit going wrong is worse usually than the thing actually going wrong.
Yeah, that's true.
Most things that go wrong, they get solved pretty on stage. They get solved pretty quickly because they have to.
Yeah. You can probably hear my baby in the background.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I think this is a good place to end it anyway. So, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to hang out. Maybe we'll see you in the US next week or month.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you're welcome. I'd love to see you, man.
Yeah, for
great
sure.
Great to meet you, man.
Yeah, man. Nice one.
Yeah. Well, congrats with the record and have a good one.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, guys. Nice one.
Take it easy.